Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the latest Ramble Meets. My name's Andy Brassel and my guest today is Maggie Murphy, the general manager of Lewis FC. Lewis FC, the non-league club in England, of course, who are the first in the world to pay their women's team and their men's team equally. Now, I've been really looking forward to meeting Maggie and speaking to her for a very long time. We almost met up during the Women's World Cup. Of course, I did a couple of at the matches out there, but we never were quite in the same place at the same time. So I went down to the Dripping Pan, the fantastically named ground of Lewis FC, for their match between Lewis women and Crystal Palace women a little while back now. And we sat in one of the beach huts that overlooks the pitch, which is their sort of executive box era, area. Absolutely fantastic. And yeah, we had a chat about everything. Maggie's just a really inspirational character. The game would be a lot better if there were more people like her in it. And I hope you enjoy listening to this and getting to know her as much as I enjoyed speaking to her. So we're just at the end of Lewis 1, Crystal Palace 1. Which was a pretty fantastic experience, I thought. We're in a beach hut overlooking the Dripping Pan, which is one of the exec boxes. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. This is director's boxes, a bit of a nod to our Sussex roots.
Yes.
And yeah, you can rent out the beach huts, or you know, they're reserved for special people. So you're obviously very special to be here now.
Thank you very much, lewisfc.com. Everyone, just in case you're wanting to book ahead. So you've been general manager of Lewis for 2 months now.
Yeah, a little
correct?
Bit under. I think it's like seven 8 weeks.
How's it going?
Started to roll really quickly now. So when I first came in, the club has had a lot of change over the summer. We've got brand new players in. I think we've only kept about 6 players from last year, so that meant that people told me, oh, don't worry, you know, before the season starts you'll be fine, but those were not football people. And as soon as I got here I realized that we had all kinds of contracts, transfers, international clearances, all the rest of it. So it was a busy few days. But as soon as the season kicked off, suddenly we're like, okay, all right, here we go, it's the football now. We're unbeaten so far. Although, you know, a little bit sore today because I think that's 2 points lost, 2 points dropped here with that 1-1 result.
Well, that's the thing. You think of, like, for a general manager, I mean, it's quite a US sports term, isn't it? You think of it as being the all-powerful kingmaker and puller of strings in NBA teams, for example.
you think of it, I think, from the outside as if, well, when the game starts, it's over to the coaching staff and your work is done. But you were feeling it out there, weren't you?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm responsible for the stadium on match days, and general manager, what does that mean? Well, it's kind of everything. All the way down from, you know, making sure that we have doctors here, and the doctors were well used today, sadly. But then sometimes I tell people this, sometimes it's like, where have the keys gone to the lawnmower? So I have to figure that out. And then, okay, right now you're going to go and do some sponsorship and marketing and trying to get the sponsors in, things like that. So it really is whatever you want to make it. I think some general managers could just deal with the paperwork, but I want to push us as far as we can, and I'm quite ambitious, I guess, so that means taking on a bit more as well. But on the sidelines today, you think that when the whistle goes, yeah, I'm meant to sit down and just enjoy the match. It's impossible to enjoy the match. It's just impossible. So it's really stressful out there. I really feel it, yeah.
And is part of that because you have a sort of football-y background? So like people who are listening to this and hearing of you and from you for the first time might not know your football-y background. When you, the thing I loved in the press release that I didn't know about you, going back to when your appointment was announced back in July, is that you played here at the Dripping Pan for Shanklin Ladies when you were 13 and scored a hat-trick.
Yeah, I did. So, funnily enough, yeah, that was... I'm only 35, but I played more than 20 years ago here. My first ever game was at the Dripping Pan. Back then, we didn't have that nice stadium over there. It was a long wooden shed. I remember it quite clearly. And the funny thing about the hat-trick was that... I'm sorry to the FA, but I was playing illegally under somebody else's name because you had to be 14 to play. So some other person called Sarah, someone or other, she got my goals that day.
And then like the Millie Vanilli of football.
Yeah. And so I was playing for the Isle of Wight, and I got back home, and then the next week, the Isle of Wight County Press put out a little feature. So this was before the days of Shanklin, actually. So it was the Isle of Wight, and they put something like Murphy scores 3 on debut for Ireland. And I was like, oh, we've got to hide that. Like, no one needs to know that I was on the pitch, but at the same time I was very, very proud. So yeah, it's funny. I've played football, I guess, for more than 20 years, obviously, most of the time legally, under my own name, and yeah, I've also, funnily enough, been able to play all around the world as well. So some of my best football moments were playing in front of 3,000 people in Tanzania, winning a cup with Arusha Town. I feel the funny thing about women's football is people often think it doesn't exist because there are these hardships, with women that are trying to play and they're not able to. But there is always a football team. There is always a women's football team. It's just that they do it despite or in spite of all the hardships they face. So, yeah, I played out in the Caribbean for a little bit. I played in Rwanda as well, and then slightly closer to home in the Netherlands and in Germany as well. So I've always found a football team somewhere.
And so going back to when you were 13 and making your debut here, I mean, how much were you aware then? Because you couldn't play in any organised teams before then, were you? Because those teams simply weren't available to you, which hopefully is something that future generations of girls won't have to put up with, and that's something you're working towards. But how much were you aware back then, even as a 13-year-old, that you were someone almost trying to fit in and find a place in a world that was very ordered for men?
Yeah, I don't think aged 13 or 14 I would have thought about it in those terms. What I did know was that I couldn't play football as a girl. And that's why age 13 I was playing in a team which had 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds in the team, and I was 13. You know, people were literally three times my age on the pitch. So I knew that there wasn't like the same access. I've got three brothers. They were all able to play for teams down the road. They didn't have to go very far. My parents didn't have to pay very much money. Even when I was playing for the Isle of Wight, I was taking a boat to away games. That's expensive. And later on, I went and played for Gosport, which was slightly higher standards. And again, so that means that training, home games and away games, I was taking a boat. And sometimes people, you know, those kind of things add up. So I had to have parents that thought it was okay for me to do this. And so I think that it's only... Frankly, I think that it was actually only when I hit about 30 that I started looking back. I was, you know, I say it was kind of in my retirement age and not playing, not able to play competitive 11-a-side as much as I wanted to. When I look back and I was like, wow, why was that so difficult? And it was only then kind of thinking through, and that's when you start to notice patterns. Why was it in every single club it was we were put on the worst pitches? Why was it that I had to pay more money than my brothers to play football? You know, why was it that I scored a hat-trick and it was literally a column inch? And we beat Lewis that day 7-1. That was much better than any of the other results that were coming in the six pages of sports results, you know, on the guys' side. So I think it's looking back, that's when I've started to put the pieces together again. And maybe also because I certainly, at the age of 13, 14, never thought I'd be working in football. Never, ever. Never thought I'd be playing, you know, never considered playing professionally, for example, because I didn't think that's what you did. And
you just didn't think it was possible.
I didn't think it was possible for it to be a career move. In fact, you know, something that sits with me in a funny way now, I remember thinking when I was about 16, one of my coaches who was kind of involved a little bit in the England setup and the rest of it, she was like, oh, you know, we can get you a scholarship to go out and play in the US. And my response was, oh, no, I don't think you understand. I'm good at school. I got good grades at GCSE. I'm going to do my A levels. I'm going to go to university. Football's not a thing for someone that gets good grades. Now I look back and think, gosh, I could have been playing in America and getting a scholarship to university. But it just wasn't even a thing, really. It was never a viable kind of career play. So yeah, I definitely would have laughed then if someone said, well, you'd be managing this club.
So when was the point that you realised that you could and wanted to work in football then?
A few years ago, I got really angry. So my career, so I, you know, went to university and all the rest of it. For the last 10 years, I've spent working in human rights and anti-corruption and anti-money laundering. So I worked for Amnesty International, for example, and later on spent a long time with an organisation called Transparency International that works on anti-corruption. And a turning point for me genuinely was the FIFA scandal a few years ago.
Right.
In fact, for me, it was all these things that I'm passionate about all rolled into one. So there was the corruption angle, which obviously I was working in. There was football, which I loved. And there was this Sepp Blatter character who was extremely... I can't even get the words out because of the way that he disrespected women.
He spoke about women's football in a certain way. I mean, he was the one who suggested hot pants, wasn't he?
Yeah, shorts and tighter tops, yeah. And then maybe attendance was all got. I mean, come off it. So I suddenly had this realization that there was something really wrong in the world of football, and things started to fall into place. I suddenly realized that one of the reasons women's football hasn't been invested in at the grassroots for so long, one of the reasons it was banned for 50 years in the UK, was because there were people at the top, like Sepp Blatter, making decisions in extremely shady ways without any transparency. And that was wrong for the future of the game, for the health of the game. And so it was at that moment that I started to shift and start to move into a little bit more of an activist-y role, promoting gender equality in football, because at that point I was able to put my career experience of you know, promoting good governance, and I was like, hang on, this is where it needs to go. The world of football needs a bit of a shake-up, and once we've shaken it up, then we'll have better outcomes for women and girls playing football around the world, and we'll have healthier people and more fair societies. I mean, it sounds a little bit crazy, but I think that if we can crack equality in football, we will change the world. We're really far away from it, but you know, everyone plays football.
Yeah.
So it's not a niche thing. Therefore, it's going to be really, really hard to crack. But if we crack it, we'll change the world.
Yeah, and obviously a big part of that was equal playing field, which you're a huge part of as well. Tell us a bit about how you got involved with that.
Yeah, so it started off in a completely haphazard way where I was at a wedding that maybe I shouldn't have normally been at, and I just got chatting to the sister of the groom, this kind of thing, and we were talking about she had been working in sports, and I was angry probably. I was just chatting away about, you know, sport, and she said, well, hang on a sec, you've got to meet my friend Laura Youngson. And very quickly she did an introduction. Laura was a person who had had this crazy idea, was very frustrated with the lack of female role models in the media when it came to sport. She said herself, you know, that there were more column inches, there were more films and videos of horses, not even horse racing, but horses, than there were of female athletes. And so she suddenly wanted to do something about it. And so I got involved in this kind of crazy challenge of climbing to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, setting a full-size football pitch, playing a full 90-minute game at the top. It took us 6-7 days to climb to the top.
Yeah.
So by that time, we were absolutely knackered, let alone... And we couldn't really breathe because it's
high. It's high.
Yes, yeah. It's pretty high. But we did it, and people were saying, you know, well, what was the point of that? And you're like, well, we kind of wanted to do something that nobody could take away from us as being like this second-class version of what guys do.
Because it's the highest... is a world record for any footballers, not just women footballers.
Yeah, yeah. And funnily enough, you know, Guinness... gave us a certificate, or the first Guinness World Record they awarded us was for the highest women's football match ever.
Right.
And we kind of had to go back and go, oh, no, women are people too. Yes. So actually from Kilimanjaro, we got two Guinness World Records, one for the highest match ever and one for the highest women's match ever.
I think you deserve two records for climbing up that high. But I mean, the thing that I noticed, I mean, you with EPF, you broke, and Laura broke three Guinness World Records in the end, didn't you? Because you had the Jordan Quest, where you played the lowdown one in the Dead Sea.
Yeah.
And then when we originally got talking, it was towards the back end of the World Cup out in France last summer, and you played the biggest in terms of the amount of people game in the week leading up to the final in Lyon.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll come on to those in a minute, but... I mean, the symbolism of it is quite rich, isn't it? Especially the Kilimanjaro one. The thing that struck me about the Dead Sea and the Jordan Quest project is it's not just about the world record's one thing, and that's a great thing, but it's actually the whole project around it, isn't it? It's the journey to get there. And how did that strike a chord for you in terms of the journey you have to make and the journey that other female footballers have to make to just to play?
Yeah, so with climbing Kilimanjaro, we talked about the fact that female players climb many mountains just to play the most popular game in the world, so there was symbolism in that. What was fascinating climbing Kilimanjaro was obviously you get no signal, right? So your phones are dead, you put them to one side, and you just have these incredibly rich conversations. And we were, you know...
And there were quite a huge variety of people that played, weren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, so we had about 30 players in total from more than 20 countries. And we also had completely grassroots players amongst us. But we also had people that had been in the US national team, who got a gold medal at the Olympics or something. So we had... Rachel Unit, former England player, you know, more than 100 caps, and then you had me. So, you know, so it was a complete mix of grassroots players and you know, players from Nepal to Tanzania to Argentina to the US, Canada, and what we realised as we were climbing, we were having these conversations, and it didn't really matter whether you were a grassroots player or whether you were an elite player, you'd faced challenges along the lines of opportunity, equality, and respect.
Yeah.
So the opportunity in terms of just having access to play and be as good as you could be, and then equality in terms of how you're treated, you know, whether you get hand-me-down kits or whether you get your own kit, whether you're on the really rubbish pitch a mile away or whether you're on the main pitch, and then in terms of respect, you know, whether you're how you're treated in the media, and how people react to you when you say you're a footballer, whether you're harassed and jeered or whether you're celebrated and you know, put on a platform.
So for you personally, was that quite epiphanous in terms of what you'd been through when you were younger? Did that start to click? Because I mean, this is back in 2017, right?
Yeah. So I mean, Definitely, it was fascinating to realise that we had all this in common. Something else which really struck me and lives with me is how tight the network was.
Right.
So because we had this shared experience and the shared understanding, we became close very quickly. We still have that WhatsApp group, we still chat on it, and we help each other out quite a lot. And, you know, it sounds crazy, but one of the coaches in Mexico, her team doing really well, she's taking them to a tournament, and she just puts out there, does anyone have any advice in terms of nutrition or something like that? And Dawn Scott, who is the US national women's team fitness coach, goes, yeah, Marisa, I'll send you over some plans. Yeah, I've got this, you know, maybe you should do this. And you're thinking, wow, Dawn, you know, you've got a job on. you've got a World Cup winning team out there to deal with, and you're spending your time sending over your support to this coach in Mexico. Yeah. And it still continues. That network just is expanding and expanding. But that kind of solidarity and commitment is something which has really impressed me. I try to explain that to people. It wouldn't take me very long if you wanted. I could probably find a player in Korea if you needed one within 24 hours, just because of the way that the networks support each other.
So I guess the themes of some of these stories will resonate with a lot of people who started to watch women's football more during the World Cup. Now, I was out there for a little bit, you were out there for a little bit, and you came back for a bit, and then you went back out there. I mean, how did you perceive the influence of the Women's World Cup and how it was received? Because, I mean, I find when I've been out to major international tournaments, basically, I go out, when I do a World Cup or a Euros, I normally go out with one team in particular, Portugal, and when they get knocked out, I go home. So it's quite interesting because you get two very different perspectives of the World Cup, because when you're in it, it's totally consuming and you have a kind of different level of consciousness. And then when you come back home and you see how other people are perceiving it and feeling it and reacting to it, the tournament feels totally different. Now, obviously, you will have had both sides of that. How did you feel the World Cup went down in France, and how did you feel that people received it back here in the UK?
So I find this fascinating because I think it's the opposite to what you'd expect. I think that in the UK we did a brilliant job in terms of having the games on free to view. That's so important.
That's huge.
It was just huge. So it wasn't, people could accidentally switch on the TV, accidentally come across the games, and then get hooked. Because, you know, football's football, sport is about stories. Yeah. You get drawn in. Suddenly you realise that you've been sat there for an hour watching a game. Yeah. And, you know, I heard a lot of people talking about, you know, how they had suddenly come to follow the Lionesses. And I think combined with that, there was some really smart work done in terms of promoting individual players and creating stories so that people can identify with the players, as opposed to it just being a faceless team of England players.
I mean, in a way, that's an opportunity, isn't it, for women's football? And it certainly was during the World Cup. That I think a lot of football fans feel like certainly stars of the men's game are quite remote. You know, they're a long way away from them in, you know, an environment where they're incredibly rich, and you know, you can't realistically meet them or in some cases relate to them. Maybe that started to change a little bit with social media, but I think that was something that came across quite strongly, didn't it, during stuff around media, around like television and radio and newspapers and internet sites during the World Cup, the fact that what a lot of these girls had been through to get there, and their stories. And that's something that, I mean, got a lot of people on the England team side, wasn't it?
Yeah. And actually, I mean, these players have brilliant stories because they have faced adversity, or, you know, they've succeeded against the odds, and they have not been academised and media trained to an inch of their life like the guys are. So, you know, a lot of journalists that I've spoken to say that they love following women's football because the players are happy to chat, have a personality, are not worried about, you know, being pulled up in a way. So you just, you know, it's really important to get those stories, those individuals. And the other thing that I thought was important about the World Cup and how it was on free to view here in the UK as well was you could follow the stories of the other teams as well. So by the time that England was starting to play Cameroon, you already knew a little bit about it. Yeah. You know, oh, Norway, right, okay, well, we've seen Norway play already, so we know what that striker's like.
Yes.
And I think when we did the Euros a couple of years ago, you know, Channel 4 took the risk and did a great job in showing the England games, but none of the other games, which means that you weren't going to follow the stories. Yeah. It's a bit harder to follow. Whereas this was just this beautiful canvas of football that you could kind of get stuck into.
And the world is smaller now, isn't it, because of the internet? And you know, I look at the way my children and their friends absorb football, and to them it's all football, whether it's English, German, Spanish, Italian, women's football, it's all football to them. And I think that is quite important. But you know, we can talk about how in one way that's as something that lends itself more to diversity. On the other hand, I'm interested to know how your World Cup was in terms of social media, because I mean, the one thing that actually maybe took me aback a little bit, we know how like prickly and just downright horrible some people can be on social media. The people who didn't enjoy the Women's World Cup, football fans who didn't enjoy the Women's World Cup, they wanted everyone to know about it. They wanted to. The lengths that some people went to, and we talked about this on one of our other shows, Jules and Andy, me and Jules Breach, like the fact that they wanted to, like there were people out there who wanted to clip up, like, you know, someone taking a foul throw, for example, which happens like every minute and a half in the men's game. But it's like, oh, this shows that this stuff shouldn't be forced down our throat. I mean, for someone like you, when the level of it, when the level of traffic is ramped up during a major tournament like that, obviously there's so much good stuff to embrace. How did you cope with that?
Yeah, it's tricky. I almost try to triage. So when I see some of the negative comments coming in, first of all, I split them into you know, whether I'm going to bother responding. I tend not to bother responding, especially if it's just pure and simple trolling. Yes. There's a beautiful Twitter account out there called Men Who Just Don't Care, and it's just basically pulling up all the people that don't care, boring, you know, don't care. It's just a funny account. So there's obviously the trolls, and I think that with the trolls you just have to not respond, because that's what they want.
Because they'll not buy.
Yeah. And then there's the next phase up, which are people who have very strong opinions but who are misinformed. And they are misinformed because they are a bit closed to learning about things. So they'll be the people that will say things like, well, actually, when they bother to get attendances up, that's when they should be paid better and things like that. And it's kind of like it's an opinion which is so staunch that they're not open to reason, I think. And some of those people, I don't know whether that's a good example, but the people that have like misinformed views, I think, I'm like, should I have this conversation or should I not? Or is there someone else going to come in and have this conversation? Is that person open to change? If so, I might say something. If they are finding an argument for the sake of finding an argument, because actually they want to sit on the troll side, they're not open to it, then it's just not worth it. And the other thing that I try to tell myself, because I can feel, you know, your shoulders get a bit tense and you read it and you get a bit sad, you know. I try to remind myself that the vocal people are a minority. That's difficult because they get such visibility on social media. But actually, I think in real life the trolls are minor, the misinformed people are a little bit larger as a segment, but then there's actually a massive group of people in the middle who are not against it. They're not necessarily for it because they've not known anything about it. And that's why the BBC coverage this summer was really good, because they're ready to be persuaded that women's football is great and technical and interesting and fun, and the players are interesting. They want to follow the story and see the players go all the way. And you just have to remember that segment is actually a lot bigger than the negative people.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As we said, you've come to Lewis this summer. It's all happened very quickly, although you seem on top of it from an outside perspective, at least. Not to embarrass you, but I was talking to the chairman here, Stuart Fuller, and he was saying what a big signing you were for the club. From an outside perspective, it does seem like you and Lewis are a match made in heaven, because for those who aren't familiar with their story, they're a non-league club, but a very ambitious one, with ambitious plans for the women's team as well, and we'll go into that in a minute. But of course, Lewis, people might be aware listening to this, were the first club in the UK to commit to equally paying men and women.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the thing that clinched it for you and made it a no-brainer in terms of you taking the job?
Definitely. I mean, I would not have taken this job at any other club. I'm a Spurs fan, but I wouldn't have taken it there. No, I think Lewis is fascinating. I mean, it took the decision 2 years ago to introduce pay parity amongst the men and the women. And even if you don't think about the finances, it's about how they value their female team. So we've just seen this game here today in front of a crowd of more than 700 people.
Yes.
And the town values this football club. They value the female team, the women's team. They play on the same pitch. They have the access to the same resources. They
train 5 times a week, don't they?
Yeah, so they're compulsory training 3 times a week, and then a couple of two non-compulsory training sessions. We're pushing on to the professional level, let alone semi-pro. So our women's team is semi-pro. We want to be pro as soon as we can. We'll shift to being pro. The club is ambitious, so it's not just, you know, every so often someone's actually said to me, you know, oh, it's all a bit of a publicity stunt, isn't it, this equal pay thing? And I'm like, wow, mate, equal pay is not a publicity stunt. This is revolutionary. It's revolutionary. The fact that we're still the only club 2 years on. So it's a combination of the pay parity, say marketing budgets, all the revenue that we generate across the men and the women's side, it goes into the same pot and then is split out again equally. But it's also it's not just a special club in that regard, but it's also 100% community owned.
Yes.
So we have about 1,500, almost 1,600 owners, which, you know, from my point of view, with my governance and anti-corruption background, I'm quite happy because it reduces our risk of being, receiving flirtation advances from a rich billionaire that wants to come in, is interested for a season or two, puts in loads of money, and then goes off again. So we're kind of reducing that level of risk, but also
makes you invulnerable.
I mean, it means that we're not going to have £1 million to spend anytime soon, but at the same time, it means that we're going to be here for a while. And then with that, because it is community owned, there are a set of principles and values, and every decision that we make at the club is informed by those principles and values. So actually, we have turned down lucrative shirt sponsors in the past from a betting company because we didn't think that aligned with our values. So some might say we're shooting ourselves in the foot. You know, you could have more money. And we said, well, actually, this is about more than football.
It's about value for the community rather than making a lot of money necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, this, as you all have seen today, you know, these 700 people that are here today, a lot of them come from the local community, a lot of them come from further, but they're very involved. This means a lot to them, and our players are wonderful, but the players will come and go, but these fans will stay. Lewis as a town is quirky and weird. I've just moved here, I'm just learning. It's you know, it's rebellious in nature. It likes to burn things. This is everything I've learned since I've arrived. But you know, there is no other town in the UK, I don't think, that would have done this before Lewis. You know, I mean, Lewis was the first club in the UK to have solar panels installed on top of the South Stand, and it was the first club in the country to put up a football against homophobia sign.
Yes,
It's very happy to be the first at things. So it's happy to be ahead of the curve, and that's perfect for me coming in.
And it's already got recognition what you're doing from the men's game as well. I mean, we talked about big signings before. Fran Alonso, the manager, is a big signing because, of course, he was an assistant to Mauricio Pochettino and sometime translator when he was at Southampton. Then he was with Ronald Koeman at Everton. And Stuart Fuller, the chairman who I was talking to earlier, was just saying when he spoke to Fran for the first time, he was just totally taken aback by his level of passion for the project. So this isn't something that's existing in a vacuum. You know, there is a sense that there are huge parts of football that people talk about football as being, you know, moneyed but an antiquated business in terms of model. There's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of football that's ready for this, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, Fran is phenomenal. If I can, I always try and sneak into the back of team meetings because, you know, my jaw drops as we run through the analytics for the game, individual stats, like running through the game plan, the tactics for the game ahead. Yeah. I find it fascinating. The level of detail, the number of hours that guy works is just phenomenal. We're very lucky to have him, but he's very ambitious as well. And I think the club knew they wanted to bring in someone that was willing to dedicate themselves to the project. Fran came because he believed in the pay parity, he believed in this, in the equality vision, and it's just part of this bigger project. How far can we take this club? I mean, look at us, Lewis FC, like running out against Crystal Palace, and we've got Chelsea in the Conti Cup in a few weeks' time. Lewis who, you know, I find that so special. We're already punching above our weight, but just imagine if we were actually able to get promoted into the top tier. I can't, you know, sometimes I wake up thinking about it. How exciting would that be? You know, just to show that football can, you know, shake things up a little bit.
And this is a huge time anyway for women's football, isn't it? I mean, in the UK, we talked about coming off the back of the World Cup. But as we sit here talking today, earlier we had Chelsea versus Spurs at Stamford Bridge. You had the Manchester Derby yesterday, which was live on television with it being an international weekend. But, you know, you had 31,000 paying customers in there.
Yeah.
If Lewis can get there, it's huge, isn't it? I mean, you're on the tip of something absolutely enormous.
Yeah. I mean, if I was a sponsor, if I had loads of money, women's football is where I'd be investing it in. There's just so much potential, and I think it's just going to boom. It's brilliant that Manchester Derby yesterday, fascinating, because those 31,000 people were all paying customers. You know, we've seen some big attendances. Well, today, you know, Chelsea Spurs, but also on the continent, but a lot of those tickets, free tickets, and, you know, there's naysayers on social media, but, oh, they're coming in for free, of course it's going to be high, and you think, 31,000 people at the Etihad yesterday, it's not bad.
And like you said, it was banned for 50 years. There's a lot of ground to make up. That's something that's frequently overlooked, isn't it, by naysayers?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons that I just think this whole kind of, well, when the women have big attendances, then they're worth investing in, or, you know, what rubbish, what terrible business sense that is.
You've got to speculate to accumulate, don't you?
Oh, right. You know, Facebook would never have got off the ground. Google would never have got off the ground if you were like, well, when it's successful, then we'll invest in it. It doesn't make sense. So, I mean, you saw how rowdy our supporters were today. They love it. They're you know, just as enthralled by the game as, I don't know. I find it fascinating when the naysayers are out there. But, you know, I also don't want to... we also have to realise that there is a way to go, and the sponsors still do need to come in, and the investors do need to come in, and frankly we need to shake up some of the governance structures to make sure that there's more women and more people from more diverse backgrounds in there making decisions as well, because
That's huge, isn't it? You know, we can think about on the pitch all we like, but in the boardroom it's absolutely crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, in the boardroom, and you know, there are a few initiatives now about, you know, trying to make sure that sports organisations here in the UK, there's a requirement that they have 30% women on the board, which is great, but they have to be influential on the board as well.
Yes.
So when you look at the kind of some of the latest FA kind of annual reports, and you look at who's actually on the different committees, I looked at the 2016-2017 annual report, and there, you know, they're increasing the number of women council members, but the only two committees that had more than two women on them were the Women's Committee and the Diversity Committee.
Right.
And then you look at the Remunerations Committee, the Finance Committee, the Nominations Committee, all male. So the people making the meaty decisions about where money goes, they're still lacking a bit of diversity. And what you don't want is to, like, put women on the Diversity Committee, please. We're over that now, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when you talk about there being a way to go, well, for me it was quite symbolic that at this time especially, the Women's World Cup was in France. I mean, I couldn't think of a better country for it to be in at this moment, because the amount of investment and seeing what that can do in women's football, I think it's never more evident than in France. I mean, I lived in Lyon for a couple of years, so I know the women's club there pretty well. And I think you can see Jean-Michel Aulas, the president, it's not just about the money, is it? I think that's the important thing. You can look at the investment, but what I think Lyon's a tremendous example of, you know, they're the greatest women's team that the women's game has ever seen. And the way that the club has run, and, you know, I think you can see, we're seeing more about it in English media, aren't we, with the fact that, you know, Lucy Bronze is going up and up and up there, and she's been joined by Izzy Christensen, Nikita Paris, players like that. And so I think, like, what is exactly what they're doing out there will become more and more clear to the English language speaking world. And I think they're planning to go back and get a few American players as well, because that's one of Aulas's pet projects as well. But to me, like, people talk about the money that Aulas and the main club have put in, but it's not just that. It's time, it's facilities, it's respect. And if you speak to Lucy Bronze, the way she says how it's just such a level up from Manchester City, who are obviously a very, very progressive club in English terms, that shows you how far it can be taken. And, you know, when you're seeing other clubs coming in with money, like Paris Saint-Germain, with Bayern Munich, like Barcelona, and they're still finding it hard to catch up to Lyon, that shows you how money's important, but a plan and a philosophy is much more important.
Yeah, and I think it comes back down to that value thing as well. Do you value your female players? Yeah. If you do, you'll put them on the main pitch. You know, if you value them, you'll make sure that their kit is perfect. You'll make sure they've got the best coaches, the best health insurance, you know, all the rest of it. And, you know, we've got a couple of players here who have played at Premiership clubs on the women's side. And, like, one of our players will talk about how... she played at Spurs, and it was kind of like, you're not allowed in the kitchen, you know, you're not allowed to make a cup of tea in the kitchen when the men are there. If Harry Kane's there, you know, and they were almost kept separate. And she says about how one time they were in the training facilities, and, you know, before any of them, they were there in their gear getting ready to train, and they were like, no photos. And this is going back a couple of years, but at the same time, it was like, no, we're professionals, we're out here to train. Like, even just that, those kind of little signals which show that actually
that it's your home as well as theirs.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, that value is really, really important. And what Olympic Lyonnais are doing is saying, hey, we value our women's team, and look at them. They've, you know, all three of the UEFA Players of the Year, the three nominations were all from Olympic Lyonnais. Winning the Champions League 3 years out of the last four, I think. So it shows what investment can do. But also, Jean-Michel Aulas, I think, you know, in terms of hearts and minds, he's already convinced. It's not just a financial decision, obviously that's worked out, but I think he's convinced that this is, you know, a part of the future of football. And, you know, anyone that thinks that women's football is not part of the future, they're just on the wrong side of history.
With that in mind, I wanted to finish with a line from your TED talk, which people can look up on YouTube. It's well worth it. Girls shouldn't have to be thick-skinned just to play the game they love. That's something that really stuck with me. And, you know, we've talked a lot about how you're ambitious for Lewis, of course, and you want them to progress. You want the women's game to progress. But to me, and I guess to you as well, this isn't just about the pros. I mean, I think about Iceland, for example, and there was lots of interest in them in the men's game about how they progressed, and they got to the point where they could beat England in the quarterfinals of to get to the quarterfinals of Euro 2016. And what I found always really arresting about their philosophy is the idea that when they created these all-year facilities for players to train and play and be coached, they were very passionate about the fact that kids who just wanted to try it out, kids who weren't ever going to be elite players, that they should have the same rights to elite coaching. How important is that, especially in the women's game?
Yeah, I think ultimately I want it to be so normal to see a bunch of girls kicking a ball about in the park. I want it to be, you know, unexceptional. I want it to be so boring, in the way that it's boring to see boys kicking a ball about in the school playground or in the park. I want it to be so boring to see girls kicking a ball about. And at the moment, you have to be pretty good to be a girl and kick a ball in a public place, because if you're not, you're going to get a few jeers thrown at you, a bit of laughter, a bit of kind of mocking. And so, you know, girls, anyone, self-conscious if you get harassed for just kicking a ball about. So I want it to be totally normal. I want it to be boring. I want there to be girls who are pretty rubbish to be playing football, and no one cares, because when boys are pretty rubbish, no one cares. That's essentially what I want. I just want it to be really normal for girls to play football. And as soon as we make it normal, we'll see more girls thinking it's normal to see it as a career, whether it's on the pitch or as a doctor or as a physio or in the boardroom. Essentially, we just want it to be normal.
Well, look, it's been great. Thanks so much for inviting us along. We wish you and Lewis all the best, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.